if you're competitive, markets are quite a good arena to play in, but you have to be at least in the top three to make money. Turn $25,000 into $125 million, essentially, or a bit more. You can segment things in different ways, but I think what we call trading at Wintermute is mostly market making. Private side is easier and harder. Private side is essentially access and filter. Can you get access to the right deals? And when you have access to the right deals, can you say this is a good deal I want to invest in or not? You needed to have at least 14 investments to see your money back. And usually the first 7 or 8, so just go down to 0. You have 3 or 4 or 5 that basically return your money or give you a bit more. And then you tend to have one investment every less than 10 that actually just has, that, you know, yields 80% of your return.
This episode is brought to you by Gnosis. Gnosis builds decentralized infrastructure for the Ethereum ecosystem. With a rich history dating back to 2015 and products like Safe, CowSwap, or Gnosis Chain, Gnosis combines needs-driven development with deep technical expertise. This year marks the launch of Gnosis Pay, the world's first decentralized payment network. With a Gnosis card, you can spend self-custody crypto at any Visa-accepting merchant around the world. If you're an individual looking to live more on-chain or a business looking to white-label the stack, visit gnosispay.com. There are lots of ways you can join the Gnosis journey. Drop in the Gnosis DAO governance form, become a Gnosis validator with a single GNO token and low-cost hardware, or deploy your product on the EVM-compatible and highly decentralized Gnosis chain. Get started today at gnosis.io.
Cars One is one of the biggest node operators globally and help you stake your tokens on 45 plus networks like Ethereum, Cosmos, Celestia, and DYDX. More than 100,000 delegators stake with Cars One, including institutions like BitGo and Ledger. Staking with Cars One not only gets you the highest yields, but also the most robust security practices and infrastructure that are usually exclusive for institutions. You can stake directly to Cars One's public node from your wallet, set up a white label node, or use the recently launched product, Opus, to stake up to 8,000 ETH in a single transaction. You can even offer high yield staking to your own customers using their API. Your assets always remain in your custody, so you can have complete peace of mind. Start staking today at chorus.one.
Welcome to Epicenter, the show which talks about technology projects and people driving decentralization and the blockchain revolution. I'm Brian Crane, and today I'm speaking with Yo Turpin, who is the co-founder of Wintermute. Wintermute is one of the largest, or maybe the largest, market-making company in crypto. And yeah, I think it's a field I'm super excited to dive in here. So thanks so much for coming on, Yon.
Thanks, Brian. Thanks for inviting us. We're the largest spot market making firm. We're not the largest across derivatives yet. Not yet. Working on it. So spot is true. DeFi most likely as well. Getting there. You know, working to be we can't claim the full name yet across the crypto space in general. We need to do a bit more on derivatives, but we're working on this. Thanks for the invite.
No, thanks so much for coming on. We hung out a bit in Singapore recently, and it was really great to talk. And so I'm super excited to dive into Wintermute. But maybe to start off, share a little bit, how did you become interested in trading and markets?
Well, okay, trading in markets, so well before crypto. So to be full disclaimer, so I'm 41 and I started to get interested in trading when I was 12. And I was essentially reading newspapers. So my dad would be a subscriber to something called the Figaro in France. And they had a main newspaper for just typical news, politics and the likes. And they had also what we call the Salmon papers, which are essentially similar to the FT. Sort of the market papers, and I was just going through this, and I just took a passion to read through that. one of these kids who had kind of 120 options of like what they wanted to do when they grow up. So I wanted to be, you know, like whatever, a doctor, a physician, an astrophysicist between essentially the age of 7 and 12. And then from 12, I really wanted to be a trader. So I got into this discussion with my dad had a like a stock portfolio that he would manage. We didn't have the internet per se. We had Minitel. So Minitel was quite popular in France at the time. You just log in into the 6637. It was similar to a web page, but you just type in a number. And essentially we just log in into the what was the credit union at the time, and we could just buy stocks as such. So I started like this, putting some orders in to buy stocks with my dad's money when I was 12. It wasn't a ton of money, but it was just enough to build a passion for it. And then I got him to buy me like an options book when I was 15. So my first options book, and then basically I couldn't trade options. So basically I found a way to trade warrants. You could only buy stuff. I was right directionally, but I realized that the banks on the other side, so essentially warrants are a bit different from options in the way that it's issued by banks, or they're like a warrant issuer. And essentially they were taking so much margin that I was right in my bets, but I was giving too much margin away. And it's probably one of the first things that led me to think of more like market making per se. So I kind of hired one of my, like a little cousin who's, I think he's 5 years younger than me over a summer, and I was going through like sort of finding arbitrage across the page and so on. So anyway, I started quite early on markets in general. I think the theme has always been that I would go through different subjects and I would get a bit bored of it. Half of my family is entrepreneurs, half of my family are educators. And then one thing I really didn't want to do at the time is just, you know, not be a teacher as such, because I thought it was just a bit too repetitive, you know, going through the same lessons and teaching the same things every year. And one aspect in markets that I love is it just changes all the time. You know, these economic cycles, it's every 3-4 years or so. You can see that in crypto, where you get like a, you know, winter, people call it more like seasons and such. And it just changes enough and it's noisy enough that it forces you to relearn things and so on. So I found that, oh, if I want to have some sort of career for 10, 20 plus years, it needs to be linked with markets. So in a way that it needs to just be refreshing enough. But yeah, that's the long short of it. And then I ended up trading my first futures when I was 18, got someone to write off, sign off a professional investor letter for me to trade futures on Boursorama when I was 18. As an internship, basically I qualified that as an internship with the school, and then I went to like a bank as a first sort of gap year, and then went to trading as a first job at 23.
So when you got interested in trading this early, you mentioned one of the things you liked was this, the fluctuating, the change. Do you think that was the thing that kind of caught your attention and got you to so deep in there, or were there like other aspects that ended up being so fascinating for you about trading and markets?
There's a competitive level that's interesting. There's a few things. I did some sales trading before doing trading like professionally, and I found that sales trading was not always aligned with the customers, and I didn't really like it. And I found that trading was much more aligned with, it's pretty clear where the P&L comes from. Like it's just I found that was just a very honest way of making money. So I quite like that aspect. You get very clear feedback, very tangible feedback. If you're doing things right, basically you make money. If you're doing things wrong, you lose money. It is much more like honest per se. So I think it gave me a sense of independence as well, to the degree that you can trade some things, you know, on your own as such. But I think it was more, there's also, you know, quite a lot of things that we do today that typically data, which we can only do because we have the infrastructure, because we have the team in the background. There's quite a lot of things that have to be quite collaborative between, you know, getting everything aligned between the right access to capital, right access to exchanges, right access to an inventory per se, right strategies and so on. So I think there's also a collaborative aspect that's interesting there. I think if you're competitive, markets are quite a good arena to play in, because it's global pretty much from day one. So if you think about us, when we started in the crypto space, it was essentially global from day one. So you know if it's going to work pretty quickly, then it's, you know, just drawing some sort of parallel with the 0 to 1. Like when it works, you know, you want to be in the top 3 definitely. Ideally, you're the first one in a certain vertical as such. So you want to be first one in, you know, spot trading as such. But you have to be at least in the top 3 to make money. But no, we interact on Twitter here and there and so on, and it's more about, I think people get somehow satisfied to be doing a bit better. But I think the realization, especially in trading, is that you need to be doing better than the competition all the time. And it's a bit more of a, you know, there's marginal advantages that you need to add on to that make it quite competitive. So it's just, keeps you on your toes.
I want to go into this, but maybe before that, then what's the story of how Intermute started?
There's a convergence of two things. There's a convergence of Yevgeny set up the company 25th of July 2017, and he was doing like little sort of hackathons here and there with our first CTO, Arup. And then on my side, I essentially had already built a few companies, a few trading related companies, but also some startup studio, a bit more of a VC advisory firm as well. And on my side, I was going back into trading in 2016-17. And I was sitting next to this ex-Marshall Wace. I don't know if you know of Marshall Wace, but it's probably the largest long-short hedge fund in London that, you know, Sir Philip Marshall, I think it's a Philip, made, you know, a few billions out of it. But essentially, they managed something like $86, $90 billion of AUM, and they do a lot of, you know, long-short, more in the equity space. And one of their first employees was sitting not too far from me on a trading desk, and he was setting up his own macro fund, and he was all over crypto in 2017. So we reviewed a lot of ICOs together, about 56, I think. And he wanted to have a macro hedge fund that would have actually a crypto sleeve, what they call it. So essentially, you have a macro hedge fund that have different strategies, and you have a sleeve of it, so part of the allocation is in crypto. And he wanted me to manage that allocation. So it came to mind that, well, I can't do this alone. I need I can trade, but I need someone else to help with, you know, just automate like everything. So more of a CTO, and I need another trader because it's 24/7. And then essentially just start, I reconnected, just discussing very openly with some ex-colleagues from trading, suggesting me to reconnect with Yevgeny. And then we aligned on this, and I joined in as a co-founder essentially late 2017. We put everything on paper with our CTO actually in early 2018. So that's the general thing. That he had just left a trading firm and he wanted to do something in crypto, and I had basically the allocation. We did not end up taking money from that fund actually, but that was enough to just rejuvenate, like rekindle the interest for me to get into crypto. And philosophically for me, it was more like I had done both trading and VC before. And I found that crypto was super interesting in terms of like democratizing like liquid, this is what we call like liquid venture essentially. So very early stage bets, but that you could get access from just with trading very, very early on, which I couldn't find in the private markets anymore, like between private and public markets in Web2. To add some background to that, Brian, Web2, like, I had done first non-listed investments in 2008, and I was a pretty active angel investor, so in London and so on, between 2012 and 15, 16, let's call it. And what I think you still have this in Web2, where in the past, like 90s or so, you'd be able to, you'd be a seed investor at Amazon. Amazon just lists like 3 years later. Sometime around 99, you can still buy Amazon at $1. You can actually get a lot of the growth and you can get a lot of the upside. But after 2010, especially, well, you get into the Uber listing, you get into the Facebook listings and stuff, and like, there's not necessarily a ton of upside left. So everything just lists like 10, 15 years into the life of the company. And it's much more, well, what we call in crypto exit liquidity, but risky equity, like the typical Web2 shareholders of listing companies just end up becoming, you know, except liquidity for VCs or private equity groups, essentially. So I found it really refreshing that crypto was trying to solve that problem, essentially. And another aspect that I love in crypto is it's more like I've dealt with people in the trading space and the hedge fund space, from the FX space and so on, and people can be a bit cagey in those spheres. And I found that actually like people in crypto were always quite open, and maybe you meet some scammers here and there, but actually in general, like people are they have pretty goodwill and quite a lot more interesting to interact with.
So I'd love to get a bit into sort of trading, and like, I think a lot of people, they will have, and I, you know, they will know trade. A lot of listeners will know sort of trading in the sense of, you know, okay, I have some US dollars, some euro, something. I want to buy some Bitcoin. I go on like an exchange and I put in, maybe a market order or maybe a limit order. And I buy some tokens, right? Like, or like maybe I do it on the exchange, I buy some shares. But I think that's probably the extent to which most people, listening here will understand trading. And obviously that's something very different from, I think, the things you did previously at, before crypto, this trading company, or then Adventimute. So can you tell a bit, like, what's trading? When you say, you're trading, like, what does that mean and what does that look like?
You can segment things in different ways, but I think what we call trading at Adventimute is mostly market making. So essentially, like, within the order book, so within in a marketplace, within an exchange, and we're there to always be there so that if someone wants to buy or sell, there's someone on the other side, someone like us, Market Mickey, there's someone on the other side there to fill our order. Because let's say if you, Brian, if we both individuals and somehow like you want to sell Bitcoin at 70K and I want to buy it at 60K, nothing happens. And then the market makers are there to make sure that we always show what's called a bid and an offer, so a price at which we can buy and a price at which we can sell, and then we're trying to be there to always to make trading easier and the cheapest possible. So what we call trading tends to be associated with market making. Now most people, to your point, like most people call trading like trying to buy whiff at $1 and hope that it goes to $2. That's often, not the greatest strategy. I think the way that most people should be trading in crypto is to see it as venture, and essentially like to put X amount of money, either they don't do any research and just stay in like BTC and ETH and sort of the top sort of 4 or 5 names as such. We start to see more what's called, more basket products and more index products as such that would give you exposure to the top 10, 20, 30 names, which is, for most people, is probably a better way to do things. How do you trade? Let's ask this start that way. I know you've done some venture investments, but do you trade any liquid tokens?
I'm very like buy and hold and don't do much else, and
do you have any leverage when you take a position?
No.
Okay, sounds
very
like you
leverage.
It's pretty good.
I don't have the impression that I'm good at predicting, basically market movements. So I don't try to do that.
Yeah, so that's quite reassuring. I have made money historically with some cycles, like in stocks or so, like taking directions, but through previous firms, not necessarily through Wintermute. As VCs, as the venture arm is doing quite well, but it's very much like venture investment. So again, to separate, like I think what you refer to as trading is much more liquid investments, but on the private side is easier and harder. Private side is essentially access and filter. Can you get access to the right deals? And when you have access to the right deals, can you say this is a good deal I want to invest in or not? And that's venture for you. The problem usually of venture or in crypto or in some other spaces is just It's just that you're married to the position. The good thing with it is that you don't tend to have any leverage. So if it goes down to zero, it goes down to zero. But you get psychologically, it's much more used to things going down to zero. Now you'll understand why I mentioned this for trading, is I think most people should consider, even when it's liquid crypto, they should consider it like a venture bet. They should consider that they're actually making an investment that actually should be pretty much risen down to zero. And they also should look at the stats of actually venture investments. So venture investments for like, I don't have the stats for crypto, but like for Web2 Angel, like even 10, 15 years ago, you could already get all the stats where you needed to have at least 14 investments to see your money back. And usually the first 7 or 8, so just go down to zero. You have 3 or 4 or 5 that basically return your money or give you a bit more. And then you tend to have one investment every less than 10 that actually just has, that, you know, yields 80% of your return. And that causes some challenges when you think of how people trade, which means that the winners should essentially return 10 plus times their money. And I think it's very, very hard psychologically for most people to think of like keeping something that does 10x and not sell it before it reaches 10x. Another parallel with this is that do you know what valuation the Uber investors invested seed? It's 2008. So 2008, do you know what valuation they invested?
I don't know, no.
$3 million. So essentially when Uber listed, people had a 5,500x. So whatever J. Carl and his friends and so on made like $25,000 into $125 million essentially, or a bit more. But that's basically the math. So imagine if Uber had been liquid before that, I'm pretty sure they would have sold some of it. And it's a bit of a challenge of like thinking of investing in crypto. You end up with a liquid venture and then you need to find a way to trade maybe, you know, but like if you sell your if you have 100x, but then it turns into a 5,000x, it's quite a big miss. So it brings us to the challenges of like comparing sort of venture and like trading, but trying to find the best way to trade is actually pretty hard.
So with the market making that you guys do at Wintermute, how do you make money?
We basically are forced into a position we don't want. We call the position basically being long or short. So long is you make money if things go up, short you make money if things go down. And we're forced into a position by providing, you know, liquidity, by just basically saying, if you want to buy Bitcoin for me, yeah.
Because let's say there's a particular coin and then you have buy orders and you have sell orders. And so that means you have to hold both sides.
What costs us money in the first place is infrastructure, people to, you know, run algos to send the orders and so on, cost of capital to usually borrow the coins, you know, on each side. And then even if sometimes we get slightly cheaper borrows, but there's still commitments, there's still some things that are associated with it.
And the borrows are often from the team or foundation or whoever is issuing the token, or
that's much less than half of what we have in the balance sheet. But yeah, some of the borrows are from foundations. Some of the borrows are used to be from the lending borrowing platforms, you know, like BlockFi and the rest. And then, you know, most of them actually went bust. So we have some borrows in DeFi that you'll know through like Wildcat, people, the Maple of the world, and so on. But essentially, a lot of borrowers come from, you know, some of our shareholders or so, or just direct from, you know, family offices and so on. So we borrow directly from foundations and other people. So we have a certain cost of capital, and then we make money by essentially being in the order book and trying to capture as much as possible of the spread. So we essentially get paid over time to take risk because we pushed, as I was saying earlier, we pushed into a position because you want to buy. We don't necessarily want to sell, but necessarily sell. We want to sell at, you know, that price. And then we hope that we can hedge it, as in we can buy back whatever we sold to you. We hope we can buy it back at a slightly lower price.
But let's say I want to buy a token and then you guys have to sell order. So now you're buying that token at that sell order. And then you hope that maybe you can sell it at a different exchange at, you know, a better price than, or buy it at a better price than you sold it to me? Or do you hope that the price moves?
Market making is actually, let's summarize it, it's quite simple. It's quite simple to explain, but quite difficult to implement. It's probably, market making is just, what do I think this underlying, so this, the Bitcoin is worth at time T? How wide do I want to quote? And how, what sort of size do I want to quote it? So you just have width, quote size, and then your mid price, or what I think the theoretical value of the token is. And then we quote around this. And as yes, there's small amounts of money that come from arbitraging. So basically be able to sell, you know, near enough at the same time, sell on one exchange, the same asset, and just buy it on another exchange at a lower price. But yeah, often it's just, it's pretty much trying to, you know, price things as well as possible. So it turns out to be like, it's much more about, it's quite a competitive space in the way that, well, to be able to trade both sides, we need to be really within the spread. So we need to be, you know, the best offer on one side and the best bid on the other side. And it's very infrastructure driven. So it means that we need to be able to adjust the orders safely, so we don't get taken out by other people. So there's some infrastructure cost in that. And obviously, like, have, you know, there's capital constraints, there's cost of capital, that, you know, because we borrow all these assets. Yeah, long story short is that we make money by taking a risk, by, you know, we don't necessarily want to be short this is Bitcoin, but you want to buy Bitcoin.
And now if you have different companies that compete, different market makers that compete, I mean, you mentioned, you know, you need to be the top or top three and stuff to make money, but what differentiates the, you know, the top from the other players?
So that's an interesting discussion I had even in ChatFly when I was at my first venture in trading in 2011, and I exited it in 2014, and I was looking at joining some other TradFi firms and just trying to learn from other people. Basically, my first venture, I was the one senior trader there, and I thought I didn't really learn enough. And I think a lot of it is actually much more about, like, a cultural differentiation. I think if you can attract the right talent, because people are very honest and they can actually just build. I think there's an aspect of people being aligned and being there and being traders for the right reasons. Often people don't actually stay traders just for money. It can be quite rewarding financially, but it's actually often people just get, if you are just interested in money, they just get the first bonus and they sort of leave and they do something else that's a lot less stressful. So either people can like math, they like whatever problem solving, they like, there's other aspects that make it interesting.
And the math comes in, like, because when you, it's basically around determining this, so the midpoint, the width and things like that, that's when you use some kind of data analysis.
Yeah. You try to predict as well as possible. Yeah. It's never an exact science, which is why infrastructure comes into play quite heavily, where it becomes a more exact science because you end up trading very high frequency. I think some people know the term HFT is sort of high frequency trading as a firm. And you end up trading, you end up making money every day, at least at the start, and ideally every hour, because you trade very, very high frequencies. So you're trading, I think we trade 4, 5, 6 million times a day these days. So it becomes very granular. So it just, it also becomes very infrastructure dependent. So it means you need to have essentially 50 plus people to go and cover, just make sure that everything is running smoothly. And especially in a crypto space, between CeFi, DeFi, between the OTC side of the business, between an API offering, you end up crossing quite a few things.
Getting into this a little bit, like, what if you compare market making in a traditional market versus crypto, you know, what are the biggest things that you need to be good at, you know, specifically to do well in the crypto markets?
So I can tell you One, I think is a good differentiation for the business is that we build a very good brand and reputation by being honest people and not looking for like the short-term optimal, but we can really reach more for alignment long-term. So I think that was quite key.
So maybe you can explain why that matters, because you'd think if you just have the orders in the exchange and, you know, it just takes the best order, I don't even know who's on the other side. So on that side, it sort of shouldn't matter, right?
So as soon as you trade OTC, you face counterparties, what we call counterparties. They're not really customers as such. They're just, because we trade as what we call as principal, so we trade our own capital. So essentially, you want to be reliable. Like when you show a price, basically, you know, you're there for a certain price, for a certain size, for X amount of time. So reliability is like being more predictable is worth something. So market making can be done. I think people in crypto space are used to hear the term towards foundations, but it's also towards exchanges. So if you're reliable towards exchanges, to that when things move around and so on, then the exchange is just the room essentially. And then you need the exchange needs people like us to be in the room to trade with many of the users. And if you're reliable as a market maker on an exchange and you know you're there when things move and so on, essentially their users will have better execution, will have a better experience in general. And that's quite valuable to an exchange. And then you just build
a good relationship with us long term.
So it's more akin to a partnership with an exchange than anything else.
And then do the exchanges also pay directly for the liquidity you provide?
Very nascent ones do, but like usually they don't. You know, you want to be in a situation where they're big enough, where they're big enough so that the opportunities they show are just, yeah, we're there to take risk with our money and take risk, you know, providing liquidity as such. But then the exchange should be there to bring new users on board and do the onboarding into the crypto space, essentially. One thing I didn't mention that's really, really key to how we build the business is that, and especially the difference between crypto and the TradFi space, is that there's a whole DeFi element that we actually focused on early on, especially from 2019. And we found that it was quite a good differentiation to the business, but also it's something that we could only do because we were much longer term focus. So essentially we took VC money and we very much pitched ourselves, and we still see ourselves as a tech company first before being a trading company. So we essentially took VC money, which was just quite different from having investors from a hedge fund space or a trading space, which means that we didn't have actually people on our back asking every day like what the results were. And we had more people, much more patient, just building, letting us build infrastructure first. So 2019, we started on DYDX, for example, in around August 2019. And that enabled the rest of the business to actually be more robust around essentially on-chain transfers, to the point that we're probably driving non-send users quite crazy at some point, thinking that they were following smart money, but they were just seeing transfers going back and forth. So if you have tens of thousands of transfers, I don't know what sort of signal they can get from it, but probably not much from us. So I think that's a big differentiation. Like being able to trade on chain is quite a differentiation from the TradFi.
What's the biggest difference about trading on chain versus on centralized exchanges?
There's aspects around obviously just direct integration with the chain, but there's aspects of managing your own custody, thinking of potential sandwich attacks as such, thinking of the risk of actually not really being failed as well, if the cost of just pushing for a transaction and not always knowing exactly when the block is going to be confirmed. There's quite different level of uncertainty in terms of what you traded and what you didn't trade between DeFi and essentially CeFi and like the traditional finance. So these things are quite different. On the other side, once you've made the effort to integrate and to build a certain amount of DeFi knowledge, then there's, if it's a barrier to entry for you, it's a barrier to entry for the people as well. It becomes a competitive advantage. There's some aspects that we we realized later as we were starting to invest. So we started to invest in different projects from late 2020, essentially from the summer of 2020. When I think it was probably DYDX with a, I don't know if it was a Series A or Series B at the time already. But essentially, because of the operational experience and trading experience and dealing with these DeFi protocols, we had a good amount of insights on just doing a technical due diligence for investing. So we ended up building like different relationships with VC firms, for example, which is basically coming to us and like not only from a potential trading perspective to help, you know, build some of the volumes for them, but also in terms of just getting feedback on due diligence on just how robust was a certain protocol, for example.
Well, what do you feel like were the key things that allowed Wintermute to get, you know, become so big? I mean, it's a very competitive space, right?
Full alignment of planet.
Full alignment of?
So full alignment of planet where you want to get into a position. There's a bit of an execution play in terms of, because we had a really good team to start with in terms of the experience we had and so on. So I had experience raising money. Evgeny built essentially, it's the first company Evgeny ever built, but he built the ETF arm of a large market maker, a TradFi market maker in Europe. So he had good experience in ETFs. And I had good experience in not only option trading, but also just raising funding as such. And our first deal was quite good in terms of getting the first skeleton of infrastructure. So we had some de-risking there. One factor that was interesting is because we ended up closing the first round of funding with quite a lot of difficulty in the middle of 2018 crypto winter, we ended up in a space that was actually quite empty. And then we ended up dealing with 30, you know, OG groups in crypto, like Blockchain Club and so on, who are quite happy to have us around. And, you know, in winters, basically the pond is very small. So you only have like a few fish that survives there. And then it's actually quite a good, this is pretty healthy interaction. Just if you're resilient enough, you're just quite happy there. I think you guys started around the same time. You were about 6.5, 7 years old as well, no?
Yeah. And of course, when we started it, basically start of 2018.
I think it's excellent for the, like in terms of the base, because you're just very focused on building. You're not really distracted with just like we are nowadays. It's very distracting. But it's fine. I'm just more than happy to see like new eyes and so on. It's just, well, the prices do the marketing for us essentially. But in general, it's kind of, it's easier to start. I think there's pretty good history even in Web 2 and Web 1 and so on in terms of people building successful companies starting like in crisis years. So that was helpful. I think it was really helpful that. Two things. It was really helpful that Evgeny had a really clear idea of like being tech fast and being like very much product driven and being, you know, everything being automated. And we never really had trader roles. We've always had dev/quant/trader roles. So anyone basically just codes and like everything gets into play very, 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 very soon, very, very quickly.
You mean, so this basically means that like it was always the focus on like, you know, building a system and building algorithms as opposed to, because I mean, I guess it's always algorithms with market making, no? I mean, I guess the people not doing this manually.
No, but you'd be surprised that there's a lot of TradFi firms who have very separate roles between people who, there's quant roles, people who build the algos, they're actually traders who do like much more manual trading actually. So you'd be surprised that we still have, even in crypto, we still have competitors who are actually trading a lot more manually than you would think. So I think there was a strong tech focus there. And the tech, the motto is things being reliable and scalable, essentially. And then on my side, I had good experience with, you know, raising equity and raising debt. So we had the capital, that access to capital, sorted, and we were all very aligned in the vision of having, like in terms of the culture, having essentially, it was more startup-like when we started than now. We had to find, we had to compensate people with a hybrid of like bonus and shares. over time because they were just getting poached a bit too much by essentially hedge funds and anyone who wanted to enter the space.
Because the shares were too much of a long-term thing. And
yeah, so it's still a balancing act, but I think we've got something quite nice nowadays. Where I think you'll end up with something like a program where people have a few shares, but they get some bonus once a year or so, and then they can reinvest that bonus as they choose. And we start to need to have basically some secondary rounds here and there.
Like reinvest the bonus in like buying shares or in like lending it to the company or something.
Yeah, essentially. So, and we very much want to, we have some VC shareholding as such, but we really want to be as employee owned as possible. And it makes a ton of sense for companies that, you know, trade their own capital essentially. Because you want best alignment possible between people who trade and people who, you know, own the capital. These things we got right. Some of the things were difficult to fully align on at the start because some of the things are much longer term in terms of building the brand, building the BD side of the business versus building the day-to-day algo and trading side of the business. But I think we clicked around, you know, late 19, early 2020, when we had the first, you know, first COVID hits in March and the first big dips in the Bitcoin at the time. Where actually we saw, oh, the algo is actually quite robust, and we started slowly to make real money. But essentially, we were building the rocket for 2 years, and we only started to really put fuel in the rocket 2.5 years in or so. So that took some time.
Was that because the algorithms weren't good enough?
Some of it was because of this. Some of it was because we had not reached enough of a critical mass between what we could show exchanges that what we could become. Because essentially, you know, exchanges you need to build a certain volume to actually get into better and better fee schedules. That was a challenge. And then simply we had not built enough in terms of getting cheap enough access to debt as well. So we're using, you know, equity fundraising to, you know, hire and, you know, build the tech, but actually for trading itself, we needed to borrow and getting access to inventory it becomes a bit binary basically. It's, nowadays we're one of the 2 to 3 firms to get essentially first steps on access to inventory, because we're quite reliable and because we try to do things quite well.
When you say access to inventory, what do you mean?
Your ability to borrow tokens from other teams or other people in general. So inventory is we trade what we call market neutral. So we don't make money if things go up and down. But it means we can't buy inventory all the time. We can't buy the tokens themselves. Because if we buy the tokens, then we're sensitive to things going down. But often we can quote a lot larger size by simply borrowing the tokens and trade around it.
Yeah, I mean, I guess you can see also here the sort of advantages of size, no? Because you trade more, and then because you're trading so much, the exchange trading fees matter a lot, and then makes it hard for someone to compete.
Yeah, 2019, we still had the down year because 80%+ of the money we were making trading was going into fees.
Wow.
But it was just, and something like a rule of thumb that kind of works for me, like for previous firms, I don't know exactly where we are nowadays, but it was more like if a third of the money we make, if you make like $1 on a trade and you spend 30 cents in fees, you can kind of run a business. Because you still have financing costs behind, you still have to pay your people, you still have some, you know, if you still have money left, you still have to pay bonuses and taxes and stuff. So like one third is maybe like moderately, but it's where you can start scaling. But yeah, 2019 was essentially 80% of the money going to exchange fees.
In terms of the interviews, company culture, you mentioned some things, but you mentioned this thing of like, you know, trying to be a sort of startup mentality, having like sense of ownership and also this like long-term focus. Do you feel like there are other things about the interviews culture or maybe the way you've hired people that have been crucial?
There's a bit of, so for further background, I think I mentioned, maybe I didn't make it clear. Evgeny and I used to work for a company called Optiva in Amsterdam. So they're quite a large firm still, they're very much an option firm in TradFi. And it's very much the Dutch culture is 100% imprinted in that company and how, you know, brutally honest Dutch people are. And then essentially it's part of the culture. There's also a big differentiation where we took the best from it in the way that it's a completely company-wide bonus pool. And we took the same thing here, which is what I noticed that and a lot of training firms are structured very differently. A lot of training firms have like little siloed teams and no one shares information. But actually when you're in a firm and trading firm that actually has a company-wide bonus pool, people do behave a lot more like shareholders as such, or at least think that if they share knowledge with, you know, the senior people are sharing knowledge with junior people, there's a lot more of that dynamic when people are happy to teach other people.
And that's basically some percentage of the profits go into this bonus pool. And then how do you determine who gets how much of that bonus pool?
There's still something that we're working on to perfect. But there's this philosophy that even people, like with us, there's even people like in legal, so like, or content, like everyone is a P&L contributor to a degree. We have internal recruiters and so on and external recruiters, but let's say we also assume that everyone helps recruiting. So I think there's a few functions like this where obviously, like, we want people to feel that owners as much as possible. And I think that has worked well. I think, a general advice for, how many people do you have nowadays in the Chorus One?
Chorus One, like 60-ish, 65, something like that.
And when did you, I'm assuming at the start you were always involved with hiring, when did you stop being involved with hiring?
Oh, I still am. I'm still interviewing.
Okay, that's good.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, I'm still interviewing basically everybody.
My rule of thumb is like the first 20 people or so is really, really key to get right, because then you imprint the culture of the company basically on the first maybe 5, 10, 20 people, and then they actually do. Then it's actually people you hired who help you scale in that way, at least scale culturally.
Yeah, I know. I'm still, for me, I see like interviewing is like just really crucial, and I think I'm pretty good at it, so I focus quite a lot on it, and at the same time I feel we haven't figured out
well,
or like I one of the things I still really want to do, and I don't think we're there, is sort of to figure out how to formalize or systematize like the interviews I do, so that I feel like, okay, I can have like other people do it. I mean, there's a few people that last year I was out for like a few months or like a month and a half because I had this like health issue. So then there was a few people we hired that I didn't interview, but I've interviewed, except for like 3 or 4 people, I've interviewed everybody.
That's interesting. I get less and less involved with it. I don't know. I mean, I need to check with Evgeny. I'm pretty sure he doesn't get involved with everyone. But I think we're very structured. Maybe we've got too many rounds of interviews and stuff maybe now.
How many rounds do you guys have?
Like for a BD person, it's about 5. They go through like a use case and so on. For technical interviews, for like some of the ops or some of the infrastructure guys, I'm not too sure. But I think, beyond that, I think cultural fit is still really a key part of it. I think if they fit in the culture. And that's kind of the challenge of the question now that we're expanding across Asia, is just maintaining that culture.
When you say see that they fit in the culture, like how do you, what questions do you ask, or how do you assess that cultural fit?
So it depends on the role. Often for like traders who move from TradFi to crypto, we'll have some ex-colleagues, we'll know people who know them, we can get a lot of third-party validation. I think there's a red line around like very much like honesty that's quite key. long-term focused. Yeah, people being entrepreneurial, being quite self-reliant, to be honest, like I like to see self-propelled. Like you just don't really need to just push them much. We have a lot of people in the company that I can just go and ping at 3, 4 a.m. Like I need to tell them to go to bed. So my head of trading is like this. Like there's a few people like this. I think there's a strain of workaholism, but I like to think it's well placed enough. But then you need to force people to be on holidays. You know, though, quite a few people in the BD team in Singapore are like this. Yeah, I think there's few elements like this, and like sort of the work ethics is very key, and thinking long term enough, and being much more mission driven than mercenaries and so on. The challenge is, I think, hiring, like the interview process is often not sufficient. So I think it's just like the first 1, 2, 3 first month is often key to make sure that we didn't make a mistake. But we don't. I think we've done a good enough job, to be honest, like surprisingly enough in the hiring, because we don't have many people even leaving that much, or we did hire fairly slowly. Think about it, like founded in July 2017. We had the first hire in September, really officially October 2018. And then finished the year with like basically 5 people total. Finished 2020, barely 10 or 12. Finished 2021. We did all of 2021 with between 20 and 25 people. And now they really started to hire more, because we turned much more into a product company from 2022. And I think we finished with 50 people, 2022 or so. So slowly, really, really slowly hiring. But thanks to that, we never had any rounds of layoffs or so.
Yeah. Yeah, that's very similar with us. One of the things that noticed at course one in terms of hiring that I feel like has been one of the most reliable predictors is whether people are really passionate about crypto. And it happened a bunch of times that we hired people who were, they seemed like a good fit in other regards, or like, we really needed someone for the position, but they didn't really seem to care much about crypto. And then none of these have worked out. They all ended up leaving, basically.
Yeah, we had this with, it was more 2022 as such. Like, I think some people are a bit too opportunistic. I think maybe they had some FOMO from 21. And then it's sort of like start, and then it just come in, and then the winter starts or something like this. And we have people who are sometimes tempted by Tried Fire as well. And it's true that 22, maybe early 23 was actually quite busy in effects and commodities. And it's like, that's fine. Like there's a few people leaving, but it's far from being the rule. Like usually people stay and, understand the cycles. And I mean, whatever, there's pros and cons to any side of the cycle, to be honest. It's a bit of a filter as well. And I'm with you that people wanted to have some passion or buy-in to the vision of the space, at least in terms of either democratization or like be a bit like slightly libertarians, whatever. Like, they need to buy to the vision of the space at least. They don't have to be as like crypto believers as, Evgeny and I, while we're quite strong libertarians. I went into crypto thinking that basically sort of crowdfunding had a bit failed. I was really into crowdfunding this in 2012. In terms of democratizing investing and so on, I felt that was quite interesting. And it's sort of like, it's so many rules around being a sophisticated investor and so on. Like, especially in the US, like if you try crowdfunding in the US, it's not really crowdfunding. You need $5 million on your bank account outside of your house to qualify to be able to invest and so on. So
I was just thinking about what I said before. I want to qualify it a little bit. I think it's passionate or at least very curious about it. I think we've also had people who worked out who were like, I'm kind of skeptical about crypto, but I'm also very interested in it, and like I'm trying to understand it, and like that I think is also indifference is probably more the thing of like that is like, okay, if people feel like it's just a sense of indifference about it, then they didn't work.
Yeah, that's a bit worrying, Ben. That is probably, it's probably a massive red flag to bear. We've had people who, depending on the roles, we've had good success with people who actually came from Tradfi, who are used to like too much structure to a degree. like work the banks or so, and they were frustrated of like not being able to do enough. And we've had good success with them because they, you know, some of them had traded crypto like PA or so. And it is a balance because we want people to understand regulation. We understand people like understand like an honest, like a good long-term framework. So sometimes people who are just purely crypto native are not a good fit. They don't understand how, you know, markets should work and so on and how it works long-term. But yeah, you need a balance. And it's good if people have gone through, you know, both worlds, both have some experience with crypto, some experience with TradFi. And I think it just ends up yielding the best profiles. We have pretty good experience hiring straight from university as well. But for more technical roles, you see, it depends on the roles.
So you mentioned building, right? And I guess one of the things that, you know, that you guys have been building that has, you know, has become pretty significant is rSync, which is the largest block built on Ethereum, or certainly one of the largest.
25 is one of three large. I think it's one of the three largest.
Certainly, yeah.
I think it is 25% of block building. I don't know the latest numbers, but I think you should know that better than me.
Yeah. Well, I know it's one of the largest. I don't know exactly right now, but so. Why did you guys decide to do that? And what's sort of the connection between the block builder and the market making?
I think it's a good representation of the fact that we tech first, that we very much build as first. And an analogy that I like to use, and you probably heard me say this a few times, but I'm not necessarily a fan of Google, but like Google is a good example that if you think of Google, it's a tech firm. It's a tech firm first, and they happen to make money from advertising, essentially. And then we want to be, and we are tech first, and we happen to make money from trading. But essentially what we do day to day is tech building. So there's only, now there's about 10 people like more like me, who's just more like externally facing and do the more commercial aspects of the business. But most other people are basically product buildings, infrastructure building, and so on. So rSync comes into play as a subsidiary as such to help with block building. And it's just, you know, making sure that, you know, we part of the block confirmations as such. We are quite cautious of not being too vertically integrated. So I think the good example of that is on DYDXV4, for example. We made sure that we actually lend a lot of our tokens as well. So we help other people to confirm transactions, for example. And we want to keep things, you know, things being a fair game. So yeah, while having some control on block building, not to be, you know, completely squeezed out of trade. So that is part of being very much part of the DeFi ecosystem in general. You need to have some infrastructure built to be able to participate in trading.
And so block building basically means, right, that it's an entity, right, that basically gets transactions either from the mempool or that people directly send to this block builder, and then, you know, basically put it together in a block and then, you know, sends that to, you know, relayers and validators, and the one that sort of has the highest monetary value that implied that it's the one that goes in there. And sort of the attractiveness here is, for example, that, you know, you can sort of construct your own blocks and put in all of the arbitrage, all of the transactions, the on-chain transactions that you guys want to do. And I guess you can also prevent being sandwiched in that block. Is that sort of the main? Would you still submit transactions to other block builders, or like all of the intermediate transactions that you guys do?
That's a good question. You need to ask one of my DeFi guys to get the full answer. But I'm assuming we do, because we would still look if another block builder is performing better, the trading team can still independently just push this to a better block builder. Like many in the space, we used Flashbots in the past and others. So I'm sure works a bit like an auction, but it needs to stay competitive enough to a degree there's enough competition in-house to make things more efficient. Because if we don't keep things efficient enough, even if it's between different teams, basically in-house, then some of the competition will take it away. You know what I mean? If we only favor our own blocks, then it doesn't, at some point it becomes inefficient. It's a good question. And I'm assuming, we'll use other blocks, but it's true that in terms of defending ourselves with against sandwich attacks, you want to have some control there as well.
So I'm curious also a bit about your thoughts on sort of the long-term evolution, both of crypto and of like what it means for a company like Wintermute, and maybe like some of the topics I'm curious your opinion about. You know, one is, you know, do you think that in the future, you know, sort of like most assets will be blockchain based and that's how markets work? Do you think that decentralized exchanges are going to overtake centralized exchanges and, you know, those will be the largest exchanges and marketplace in the future? Or like, how, where do you see things going?
Yeah. So it's funny because I've had different answers to those questions over the years. One thing is I'm one of these guys who's cautious with, like, you know, people like Larry Fink, for example, they're saying everything will be tokenized. I think a lot of things will be tokenized, but I think for some aspects, like around RWA, for example, so real world assets, so like around sort of like tokenized equity and stuff, it's been tried before. And some of it, if it doesn't bring a sufficient like factor of improvement, it's quite difficult to distribute and just to get adoption. So I think it will happen, but it won't happen all at the same time. There's a few things in the crypto space that I'm still really eager to see. Like, so I'm in Asia now for 6 months because we trade derivatives from Singapore office. And I think there's a big thing that's still not happening if you compare the crypto space with TradFi. There's still very, very little volumes in options, for example. So essentially options in TradFi trade is 25% of the total volumes. And in crypto, it's a tiny percentage. It's just very low single digits. And I think there's a few factors to explain that, but I think it's just like with a bit more that actually positively institutionalization of the space, there will be more people around the table, and actually we'll get more derivatives that. More derivatives mean more better price discovery down to the underlying tokens, so down to the base spot token as well. That's the second trend, so that like more derivatives, more tokenization for sure. I think it was 25th of April 2022, I gave a talk in Davos about DeFi flipping CeFi. And I was quite happy to just go talk
you
DeFi.
You have such a memory for dates. Whenever you were like mentioning date, you were like, exactly, okay, it was incorporated on the 5th of July
25th. It's more sequestric. There's the very few things I'm good at. So just remembering people and remembering dates.
Yeah.
it's funny because I was at this, I don't know, like I'm going to name the foundation because they invited me to speak there, but I went in, had like a little booth and so on. I had like pretty nice discussion there. And we were just right next to WEF, and they were all, you know, WEF guys that basically all talk about, oh, 90% of the money is DeFi, is like criminal money and blah, blah, blah. So it's all rubbish. We all know it's rubbish. But I was happy to talk about like potentially, you know, what we needed for DeFi to flip CeFi. And it was interesting because there was like, so April 22, as I mentioned, obviously we had FTX in November. And then my first reaction when FTX went down was like, oh, people will realize that the Fed is because of centralization and that people would just go for DeFi and so on. And the problem is that I was talking about this with my partner at the time, was that it's like, actually CeFi is very good for adoption. CeFi, basically the centralized exchanges, regardless of, you know, risk of fraud and centralization and so on, is very much there to onboard. They actually onboard the new users. And when people get sufficiently familiar with the tech and so on and get sufficiently incentivized to basically do custody themselves and essentially confident enough in like the tech to actually send funds on chain, then they really are part of DeFi. But at the time it was about, so 22 is about 400 million total users like across the crypto space, and you had about 6 million, 4.5, whatever, four, let's call it, it was 300 million total users in the crypto space, and there was about 400 4.5 million DeFi users per se. And now it's doubled across the board, but I see the percentage of DeFi users stays the same. And it's a bit of like, there's a bit of a failure in terms of like DeFi in the way that we did have like good traction around DeFi summer because there was like zero yield everywhere or negative yields in most of the places. And basically DeFi was able to attract some users through you know, having some yield. But essentially there was a whole phase afterwards where, well, TradFi actually ended up getting yield again. And I think the DeFi space and essentially crypto was just a bit struggling on the yield front, so not super attractive there. I think there's still a lot of things to solve in terms of UX, UI, getting that leverage in DeFi, that's some sort of, you know, credit scoring in the meantime and so on. A lot of people are building pretty cool things to help solve these things, but I think we still end up with this sort of bottleneck from the for DeFi to really flip. CeFi is actually still quite challenging because if you see how people are onboarded into the crypto space, it's still very much CeFi first. And then.
But if you think like, you know, 20 years or 10, like a long-term future.
So I think DeFi can be much more prevalent once you get once you get robots everywhere, once you get like a proper Internet of Things, because then whatever your fridge, buying your food automatically based on what you've eaten the day before and stuff, your fridge is not scared of like sending funds online, or your fridge is not scared of doing the custody or stuff. Or like probably does this maybe you just have your house wallet or whatever you want to phrase it.
Yeah, and you can have your fridge sandwich to the heating system.
Exactly. Disproportionate like hacking risk as well, but I think it's like the machine to machine trade. And it's also like this in 20 years time. I think it's pretty normal, but I think that's probably pushes DeFi first. And it's surprisingly, if you talk to institutions, a lot of them are like, there's a few, even 3 years ago, I had this side chat, this little chatter house, like chat of after a panel at a London conference. And they were like, traditional finance, you have like these guys who call like very much custodians who hold all the people's money. And so like this top 10 out there, whatever, JP Morgan is one of them, but like I think BNY. There's a few Australians there as well. And there's a few of these custodians who are completely ready to think of a world where DeFi is first, but basically they want to be the wallet. So basically their thing is like, okay, people can trade bilaterally everywhere, but like they want to secure the funds essentially. So there's a future there. I don't know how much we have to pay them, but it's, you know, I think that can work. The reality is it's not happening yet.
And maybe one more topic when it comes to sort of, you know, the future. What about AI? Like, what do you think is the impact of AI on like Wintermute?
Very little in terms of pricing itself. I mean, most of what we do is already fairly automated. I think there's a really annoying aspect that I'm trying to get my head around is on the commercial side. Is around risk of fraud or people impersonating and so on. It's more and more possible the tech is there for you to think that you could have had the podcast with me, but you could have had the podcast with someone else sitting in, you know, from the 50 Cent Army and actually just not using Gemini, using some AI tool to basically replicate how I move, how I speak and so on, and think you have a commercial call. And then convince you to send me money for like, you know, for a deal and so on. Yeah, I think we're not too far away from having to go back to like physical locations and like having different offices in different countries and then just having people to just check in that, you know, that we have this. But actually blockchain solves some of this because you think of that, you know, for us to have, you know, either it's linked with an address that's like we recentralize it or not. We have a few points of validation that we can check and we can function trustlessly, but it's that's a bit of a concern, because there's aspects of our life in AI also and like in tech in general where we favor convenience over privacy over many other things, you know, over security, and I think it's a bit of the risk there as well. So I don't know how do you see AI affecting your business as well.
I mean, for us, it's a pretty significant focus. I mean, we have like a team that's like focused on basically building sort of like, I think the obvious thing is that I think it could just improve everyone's productivity by like maybe, you know, maybe 20%, maybe 50%, maybe 100%, like by a lot. But then I think to do that, you know, it's not like easy. I don't think you would get that just from like using like ChatGPT or something, but you actually have to like integrate it into how the entire organization works. So that is like a focus for us. I think that is the sort of thing where it can become like something that's, you know, very compounding where, okay, maybe this year will help us like 5%, right? But maybe next year it will be 20%. Then maybe the year afterwards it will be like 50%. And then I think these effects can just become like massive over time.
AI is like, for me, AI is like, so I used to invest in AI businesses in more than Web 2. And you can sort of put them in like optimization, automation, or discovery. And like, and then if you get, so by the sound of it, what you think is more optimization at this stage is still like a 10, 20%, you know, marginal improvement on your site. But I think if you just get generally inside, like if you get the discovery aspect of AI, that's actually quite useful.
Well, what do you mean with discovery?
Yeah, discovery is like, think of an AI that can think of like, you know, AlphaGo is probably an example of this. Like, some, you know, an AI is playing completely differently. Or I don't know if you apply AI to like biology and just finding, like discovering like new treatments or so.
I think that will probably emerge, right? But I think the first thing is like kind of like, I mean, for example, one thing is like, in terms of a sort of thing we would like to have. So right now, you know, we run all this infrastructure for, you know, lots of different blockchains. And then, you know, we have all these engineers on call and then there, you know, systems to like alert and then something happens and there, someone has to look at it and then like respond to it. So like, for example, can you build a system that like knows how all of the issues that have arisen and all the ways they've been resolved. And if there is an alert, it can like basically, well, autonomously resolve it. Or maybe at least suggest to the engineer that comes up, hey, this is alert, probably you should do this, right? And then maybe they can check, but maybe at some point it's not necessary to check. You can just go ahead and do it. So something like that is, for example, something we want to build. But it's not easy. Right? It's going to take... probably going to take 2 years or something.
What is it? I think it's 83 was neural networks. 2006 was the Bosman, how do you call it? Bosman machines and so on. And then like it took a really long time. I think a lot of progress has been made in AI just by like doing, just playing around with an optimization curve. I think people were quite surprised with this, how far we went. And I don't know, I haven't looked at this. I played around with ChatGPT and so on more recently, but it's like LLMs are quite interesting because essentially anything that deals with words used to be considered very, very difficult. Like you could build some trees, you could build some things that actually just do like chatbots, you could build them like in a narrow sort of a lexicon, so a narrow set of like very narrow context. And now the fact that we can have LLMs is quite interesting. So don't know. I think it's often the thing of like we sort of overestimate what we can get in 2 years and we massively underestimate the changes in 10 years time. So we'll see where we are there.
I'm just curious about the last thing. So I understand like you know like a lot of languages and you learn a lot of languages. I'm curious like how do you learn languages and how do you maintain the languages that you learn?
I learn them fast and I maintain them very difficult. It's very difficult for me to maintain them. So I'm still maintaining about 5. And when I don't work 24/7, I used to just have just watch movies or read or trying to read in a language or try to. Like I love Singapore for like Asian languages because you can maintain Chinese, I can maintain some Japanese, I can learn Korean slowly with the limited time I have. There's 2 to 3 big dimensions. There's something in learning that you call schemas. It's sort of like the scaffoldings of like how you learn. So essentially, let's say if you're French, let's say this, you have similar schemas to like Spanish and Italian and so on. So basically like like same sort of framework. I know it's quite easy for you to, like, to learn other Latin languages. But once you just like you're European and you learn Asia language, like it takes a while to get there. If you've got good memory for new words, it's useful. But there's still a dimension where even you understanding like rough grammar is not sufficient to really just, you know, like to put words and speak perfectly. I think a good way to do things is just consider yourself a child and basically don't be fussed about making mistakes. Like I just half joke about torturing people, like learning a new language, but basically you're torturing people. We're going to listen to you. Like basically you're going to make mistakes and so on. And I think people are, especially when you learn a new language as an adult, people are too fussed about making mistakes. And I think it's a good lesson for learning in general. Like it applies to languages where it's useful.
When you learn a language, you focus on one at a time, or do you sometimes learn multiple at the same time?
Just one at a time, usually. One at a time is much easier. The thing is to get to a level where you should be able to have at least a conversation, or at least watch or read like kids kind of material or so, like simple things, because you want to be able to maintain it. And then you can only maintain it if you can have a mix of active and passive learning. So active learning is really you literally like learning new words and so on, and learning new sentences and practicing. And passive is basically just you watch a K-drama show or something. Or, you know, it's much more passive. But at least what's quite key is get your ears to hear all the sounds. And I found this I found it difficult for like Korean, for example. Like for Chinese, it's really difficult to get around all the tones. I mean, just the tones, and they just generally get around it. Many people use soft tones in Chinese as well, so it's more like you just need to end up having to learn, you know, to say like the same thing three different ways, and just make sure that you can be understood. Then just by practicing and be a bit shameless about practicing, and just I think this is the biggest barriers for adults actually. But in general, it's just I find this fascinating in terms of language learning, because it's usually like 50% of the language is about gives you good insights on the people's culture, because this is about, you know, who speaks to who and how they articulate things and so on. It's quite it's just a mash the top. That's just a GTA exercise, but it was my pastime for a long time. I don't know what's your favorite language, or what's that to ask very tricky questions.
Well, I mean, in college, I studied quite a bit of Chinese, and then I spent some time in China too, and I spoke pretty well at the time. So this was a long time ago. This was like 2006. So I was kind of, you know, I could have like a 2-hour dinner with someone and talk in Chinese, and I could like, you know, and then I did not use it at all and I really enjoyed learning Chinese. I just found it fun, like more fun than learning other languages. And then I basically didn't practice at all, and I forgot kind of everything until like when I was in Singapore, like in January, I started studying again a little bit. And so I've been studying, you know, every day for about, you know, seven weeks. And, you know, it's coming back kind of to some extent. Yeah, so I think Chinese is the one I enjoyed learning the most in terms of studying the language.
What I found difficult for you for Chinese and Japanese was that if you're just really in it and you practice every day, you can get to a really, really good level, just reading and writing as well. But I find that the spoken, and so understanding people speaking in the, you know, general spoken level is not too difficult to maintain, because you can watch shows and stuff and so on. But I found that maintaining reading like and writing at a proper level, it gets very difficult with, you know, all the Hanzo, all the Kanji to maintain. That's something that needs to be a lot more active on my side. But
yeah, reading, I never managed to get to like, I never could get to the level where I could like read a newspaper or something and like understand a lot.
I can send you some books. There's a book by someone called Richardson, who's like, who basically, he actually started with a Japanese book. The legend is that he was in the 70s in Japan, and basically learned like all the 1914 whatever official kanji list in less than 3 months. And he used like a memory palace kind of method. So he would just deconstruct the root of the kanji and basically just build around it and build a little story around it. And is this called Remembering Kenji? And actually, there's a Hanzi, there's a Chinese equivalent that's been same writer, I think it's also Richardson. I used this in 2009 or 10 or so. It's all the positives and the downsides of Memory Palace, and when you build a story around remembering something, it's kind of slow, like, but you actually remember it. So it's kind of slow to recall, like signing the whole story around, oh, there's a ladder, there's something, there's a moon, there's a sun, there's something. And then you can rebuild the kanji or the hanzi. But it's kind of slow. So it's useful in like a first kind of practice. And then you kind of forget about the story and you just, like, it goes into the long-term memory, and you just, once you read it, you just read the right sign as it is. But if you have a bit of a barrier to remember them, it's quite useful. I'll send you the reference.
Cool. Well, thanks so much, Yo. It's really fun to have you on. We enjoyed our conversation.
Thank you. Same here.
Thanks so much for listening, for tuning in, and we'll be back next week.
Thank you for joining us on this week's episode. We release new episodes every week. You can find and subscribe to the show on iTunes, Spotify, YouTube, SoundCloud, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And if you have a Google Home or Alexa device, you can tell it to listen to the latest episode of the Epicenter podcast. Go to epicenter.tv/subscribe for a full list of places where you can watch and listen. And while you're there, be sure to sign up for the newsletter so you get new episodes in your inbox as they're released. If you want to interact with us, guests, or other podcast listeners, you can follow us on Twitter. And please leave us a review on iTunes. It helps people find the show, and we're always happy to read them. So thanks so much, and we look forward to being back next week.